Before we start part two,
okay.
I just want to make a brief announcement. Even though we did not at all advertise this in Toronto, but the truth of the matter is our conference is being broadcast live on the internet as we speak. And I want to give a special thank you to Shalom Eisenstadt for his unbelievable work over the summer in getting, you know, E-Team with all of its meanings, electronic Torah in motion, E-Team, Kabbate, E-Team, LaTorah, up and running. We did have a class, you know, prior to Rosh Hashanah, Menachem Liebtag, and you see in the package you got, we're doing four different people starting in a week and a half. This is amazing technology. You can be at your computer, you hear the person live, you can talk live, and everybody else on the system can hear you. If you don't want to talk, you can write in your answers, everybody can see it. If you want to bring a webcam, not only can you talk and be heard, you can be seen. And it's really like being in a live class at your computer. So I strongly encourage everybody to to sign up for any of these classes. We're doing a couple of them at lunchtime at your office, 45 minutes, one in the evening, one in the morning. So that's really what I wanted to announce. We hope we'll see all of you in the morning. We have a full day, 13 sessions, I think we have tomorrow. As you know, at every time slot, we have choice. The descriptions of the sessions are in your pamphlet to help you choose which one you would like to go to. The ones you don't go to, you can afterwards download it on MP3 on your iPods, put it in your car, in your CDs, however you want to do it. We are in the middle. I want to thank you know, Randall Craig also, really, for all his help that he's done, him and Shalom, and for all the help he's done us in general. It's very dangerous once I start on the thank you, but those are the two special thank yous I want to give, and we hope we'll see you tomorrow, and we want to hear your comments and your feedback, and we hope it'll be a most meaningful day. Okay, part two, enough of me.
Just a brief note about the structure of the evening. We're going to be going for quite a while yet, and then I definitely want to leave time for any questions that people will have from the floor. Where we left off was that Rabbi Haman was actually talking about a very significant shift in not only in really the self-perception of religious Israelis in terms of how they see their place in the society, and also a changing demographic, which suggests that the power structure of Israel will change, is changing, and will change very soon, and that the kind of classic perception, almost a kind of ghetto perception, as I read it, of the embattled sort of religious minority within the enclave, staving off sort of secular oppressor, is really changing. And it's actually Dafka because of that changing demographic that the secular populace, as Rabbi Haman analyzes, is actually kind of fighting back, really out of a sense of desperation. And I know that Dr. Furtziger wanted to jump in on that.
It's a very quick jump. You know, Rabbi Haman and I are very dear friends, and he actually... I owe him a tremendous amount of hakarat tov because he was the person who brought me to Bar Ilan University, and I'm very proud of that, and I appreciate that. When we first worked together, when he was the dean of students, he found out that I play tennis, and for a while we used to play together every Friday, and then I started beating him, and I don't know what happened, but we remained good friends. But I just wanted to say that. Jonathan Sarna, who's a wonderful historian from Brandeis University, wrote a very short piece about orthodoxy and orthodoxy in America. And he made one point that I think that we have to keep in mind, not disputing what Rabbi Haman said, because I think that they are, you know, very, very... thoughtful comments that deserve more thought than I would want to give to them at this moment, and they deserve a lot of expanded discussion. But he said, this is where I think history is a very important thing. He said, you know, we see a lot of Orthodox triumphalism. We see a sense that we're not only surviving, but at this point we're growing and everyone else is assimilating. Everybody else seems to be slowly withering away. And he's speaking about America, but I think that we can sort of transfer that over to Israel to a certain extent. So I think it's important to remember that if in 1906 you were to ask a Jew in America, where is the future of American Jewry, unquestionably they would have said the Reform Movement, because the Reform Movement was conquering American Jewry at that time, while the Eastern European immigrants were, not all of them, but a lot of them were throwing their wigs and their tefillin overboard as they reached Ellis Island, or were certainly for economic reasons abandoning observance. And many of us stem from families that dealt with those issues in the early 20th century. So I think that balancing between certain realities that seem to point in a certain direction and having a little bit of, I think I would call it historical humility, is very, very important, because we are liable to develop certain tendencies and certain policies based on a certain assumption of a future. And if that future doesn't come to fruition, we may, in the process, cause a level of disengagement, to segue into the next topic, that is ultimately more destructive than the possibilities for building that exist.
I want to read to you a quote from the head of the Hesder Yeshiva in Petach Tikva. He's a very interesting man. His name is Rabbi Yuval Sherlo. Rabbi Sherlo is really a very thoughtful thinker, and he wrote the following at the beginning of 2006. Quote, "In Israel today, we hear two utterly different narratives of the destruction of Gush Katif. The difference is already evident in the name. We religious Zionists call what happened destruction, expulsion, uprooting, racist transfer. An absolute majority of the secular public, however, refer to it as disengagement. We regard the expulsion as a traumatic event whose reverberations will never be forgotten or forgiven, while for the other sector, it was an insignificant event, no longer on the agenda. We see it as an act of dictatorship, tantamount to usurpation of government by corrupt, underhanded means, but an entire sector of the public sees it as a legal democratic act, perhaps rather crooked, but such are the ways of democracy. We feel that our disproportionate contribution to the army and elsewhere has gone unrecognized and earned us no gratitude, whereas the others feel that we have trampled everything that they value and hold sacred. These two narratives are the real threat to the state of Israel. That each side is immersed in its own narrative without understanding that that of the other side clearly heralds an imminent rupture." Unquote. My question to you gentlemen is, how do you feel about these remarks? Is there an imminent rupture taking place or about to take place in Israel between those that see the settlement of the land, all of the land, as the paramount raison d'etre of Zionism, versus those who not only do not share those values, but see them as dangerous and even fanatical? In other words, are we looking at an Israel that is fractured in the most basic of ways?
I'd like to answer that question. I don't know the answer, however, because I don't accept the question, and I would like to explain why. Look, we can, if we wish to assume the mantle of prophecy, as has been pointed out by Rabbi Heyman and Dr. Furtziger, if we want to assume the mantle of prophecy, it can probably go either way. I mean, Yirmiyahu HaNavi said, 50 years. Hananiah ben Azur said, 2 years. Of course, everybody believed Hananiah ben Azur, even though his credentials as a prophet were not sterling. I mean, it was Yirmiyahu that had the platinum credit card. You know, Hananiah ben Azur, he just got in, you know, by the skin of his teeth. And yet everybody believed Hananiah ben Azur because he said something that everybody wanted to hear, which was, if you have to go to the diaspora, make it a short trip. Whereas Yirmiyahu said 50 years, and for people who lived in Yerushalayim at that time, 50 years seemed a long time. So I think that it would be a good idea for us, as I think Dr. Fersica said, to avoid prophecy. I don't know what's going to be. Now, how do you assess the situation? Obviously, there are people who are unhappy. And those people begin with the people who lost their homes, a very unhappy kind of thing. There's no amount of money that can replace the feeling that you have when you're forcefully ejected from a home. And forcibly ejected by the people who put you there. It wasn't as though Israel was conquered by some foreign nation. The people who sent them, who told them to build their homes there, their representatives, were the ones who sent them away. Now, this is a very sad event. On the other hand, and furthermore, there are many people who, out of sympathy with those people who lost their homes, put up a staunch and very emotionally charged opposition to what was happening, even though eventually they lost. Now, somebody says that this is something that's going to rip Israel apart. Now, how do you measure? How do you know? So I want to make a suggestion. The state of Israel was not created by state planning. The state of Israel was probably, in many ways, the worst mess imaginable that the Jewish people could have ever put together. If you just learn Jewish history from about 1940 until, let's say, about 1983, the Yom Kippur War, you find that, 73. Oh, thank you very much. Now I know somebody is listening. No, it was really a mistake. But I'm a teacher. Your teachers learn to do that. You never give in to students. Anyway, we're going to survey Jewish history from 1940 to 1973, right? Like we're going to make it state. We're going to make a Knesset. Now, you know that the state of Israel for a long time was the only state in the modern world that had three, you can count them, everybody can count to three communist parties. One of those communist parties was dedicated to the destruction of the state of Israel. And this communist party that was dedicated to the destruction of the state of Israel was not an Arab communist party. No. It was a Jewish communist party with tremendous, with backing from kibbutzim and moshavim, the pride of the Israeli world, right? And into this mess with three communist parties, one socialist party, Ben-Gurion said, we can make a coalition with anybody, but not with... Oh, you don't know modern Israeli history. You have to go back to Israel and take the course. Not with Herut. Herut were considered to be this same Herut. You say the same guys who run the government today. You know Kadima is a name. It's a make-believe name for Herut, right? You know, so they are running the country. Ben-Gurion said that they are anathema. They're not just bad people. They can't do tshuva. That's what he said. They can't recover. The Kedron comes. You imagine the two largest parties in the state of Israel said about each other that they are unable, unlikely to be partners at any future time. Into this mess come the religious parties. Everybody else agreed that nobody wants to be religious. I mean, these guys are just relics. They're left over from some prehistory. We don't know how they got here, in Israel, I mean. We didn't want them. We tried to mess up their children, to send their children to secular schools, and here and there, and cut off payers off the Yemenite kids. We did all that stuff, right? We did all that stuff. That's what the state of Israel was forged in. You know what forged is? This is what we are resting upon. Then, with all of this happened, the army didn't quite function in this war, and so it did better in another war, and then it wasn't quite functioning in the Yom Kippur War in 1973, which then eventually led to a revolution where Herut, the bad guys who nobody would talk to, rose to power and took over the country. And what they did in turn was destroy the collectives. Something we were talking about, collectives and individuality before. But the turn of individuality in the world came, and the turn of collectivism disappeared. So they said, okay, let's get rid of all the collectives. You know what they call collectives in Israel? Kibbutzim. Yafeh. Get rid of them. So what happened? These poor kibbutzim all had to become viable industries. That's what they did. They all became businesses. They all went into business and they became individual collectives. Collective individuals. So this is how the state of Israel was forged. Into this melee come the religious Jews. Now the religious Jews didn't know exactly what they were doing. But min hashamayim, mamish, if there's no other explanation, the two large parties in the state of Israel never had quite enough. They never had quite enough. They couldn't run it by themselves. Of course, they were stubborn. They're not going to run it with each other. So they went to the religious parties. So they say to the religious guys, look, if you guys just keep quiet and don't do it, we'll let you be in the coalition and we'll give you money. So the religious Jews, who always understood that money is worth more than anything else, the religious said, no problem. We'll come to the coalition and then we'll get the money and we'll do what we want with the money. So even though, of course, a lot of religious Jews are a little corrupt and other religious Jews are very corrupt, so in spite of that, somehow, in some misguided manner, a lot of this money went into Torah education. And all of a sudden, people wearing kippot of all designs and stripes and forms appear in the street of Israel. Here's Ben-Gurion. He said, we don't want them here. We're going to read the Tanakh and walk around Israel and look at archaeological digs, and we're going to make new Jews. And here it is, 40 years later, all he's got is old Jews. He doesn't have, the new Jews look just like the old Jews used to look. And they do the same thing, even though it's true, kippot through goat is a little bit of a departure. But you have to imagine, if a kid with a kippot through goat learns in a yeshiva 15 hours a day, he smacks of the old style, doesn't he? Even if he wears a kippah sruga. I mean, you could imagine that the mistake that the non-religious Jews made should be, could be, might be, can only be attributed to divine providence. Because no one could make such a stupid mistake without being helped by heaven. So my assessment is that the state of Israel has had a lot of problems and has weathered a lot of storms. And in the course of weathering all these storms, it has become one of the strongest militarily, financially, economically. I mean, it's absolutely an unbelievable story. Someday, people will write the story and they won't believe it. How could it be a country of 5 or 6 million immigrants? You know that in the last 15 years, we absorbed 1 million Russian Olim, which is exactly 20% of the population. Now, you figure out how it would be if in America that has how many people in the United States of America, not this part of America, 300 million, 20% of 300 million is 60 million. If 60 million Russians landed in New York on one day, I mean, what would they do? What would they do? I mean, the Americans would shoot them or something. They'd send them all to Iraq. I mean, who knows what they would do? I mean, you can't imagine it. You can't imagine what happened in Israel. They came. They started playing violins and cellos in the streets. And now, just 10 years later, they're taking over the country. Right? So this Israel is a miracle. Israel's a miracle. It's built on miracles. It's based on miracles, even though it's hard to plan for miracles. Hard to plan for miracles. But looking back, that doesn't mean that everything is wonderful. And it doesn't mean that everything has worked as we want it to work. But it's absolutely remarkable that in Israel, there are no major ongoing battles between the segments of the population. Yes, there are flare-ups from time to time. And I want to get to disengagement. I have an opinion, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. You can write to me, you know, and I won't answer you. I have an opinion. I'll just tell you that when they had the disengagement, guys from the yeshiva went, but I didn't go. So they all said, it's because he's old. So I said, okay, maybe. I don't know. I don't know if it's because he's old. So I'm going to tell you about disengagement. One thing is clear, besides if you just ignore the doomsday sayers, the people in Israel think that the state of Israel is more important, is more significant, is ultimately of greater value to the Jewish people than the idea that was either positively or negatively determined at the time by the prime minister, whose name was Sharon. In other words, a fighting about disengagement means blowing up the enterprise. The people of the state of Israel are not interested in that result. And so I think that Yuval Shurlo is talking about a very small group of people who have no real influence and make a kind of a thing about saying radical and disorienting and annoying things, which is not to say, I don't want to be misquoted, that disengagement was not radical, disorienting, annoying, and unpleasant. It's not to say any of that. It's just that if you put it to the people of the state of Israel in that way, they say, you want to fight about disengagement, or you want to move on and build the state of Israel? My feeling is that the people have proven, this is not a prophecy, but they've proven from the 1940s until 1973 and 83 and 93 and up to today, that we are committed, we as a people, even though it's true community is less important than individuality, but even individuals form a community sometimes. And the community of Israelis, the sachakol, the cumulative value of the individual effort in Israel says we want the state of Israel to exist. And since we want the state of Israel to exist, we'll scream and we'll yell, but eventually we'll compromise. It's like brothers or sisters. You know, your brother comes into your room in your house, right? Your brother comes into your room and messes up your CD collection. Ooh, that's World War VII, right on the spot. But when there's a problem, he's your brother, and you help him, and you forget all the times that he annoyed you. And I think the people in the state of Israel are like that. What's interesting about the army is not, to my mind, whether the mefaked is an atheist or he has a kippah sruga. What's interesting about the army is that in the army, everybody realizes more than any place else that there's a togetherness in the effort which has to be maintained. Which doesn't mean I like you, and it doesn't mean I want to live like you, and it doesn't mean that I think you've got the right ideals or values. Not at all. But there's a togetherness, because the people of in the state of Israel happen to be brothers. And when the chips are down, they react together as brothers and defend what they have, which is the state of Israel. So far, very successfully, and I hope that the future will tell the same story. You want my CV?
May I tell another story?
Yeah. A story.
I want to tell you about a 90-year-old woman who 15 years ago left her apartment in one of the major hotels in Jerusalem because she wanted to contribute to the state, and she moved to Neve Dekalim in Gush Katif, and she built a home, and she planted fruit trees and created a beautiful little paradise of her home. And that was my mother-in-law. And when she was taken out of Gush Katif, when we saw the disengagement was going to happen, and I called her and I said to her, Savta, things are getting pretty warm and it's going to get a lot hotter. Maybe you'd like to come and live with us for a while until things kind of blow over. She said to me, Pinchas, you should be ashamed of yourself. How dare you suggest to me to leave my home just because some politician says I should go? Well, the result was that she was removed from her home. She originally said to me, it'll take 8 soldiers to get me out of here. She said, I will not go peacefully. But she did. She did go peacefully. And she went to a temporary apartment in Jerusalem. She went through a traumatic period of time. She was traumatized psychologically and emotionally. And she went blind as a result of this experience. She was traumatized and damaged by it. She's now 91 years old. And in a recent conversation with her, we see her a lot. She lived with us for 3 months, which is something for which I will never forgive Mr. Sharon. But in the course of all the conversations with her, I said to her, so Savta, what are you going to do now? She said, well, what do you think I'm going to do? She said, I'm going to resettle. I said, you're 91 years old. She said, so what? I'm going to resettle. I've just bought another apartment in Beitar. And I'm going to move into my apartment in Beitar. And I said, Savta, maybe you should live with one of us. She said, why? I want to settle the land. Now, what do I learn from her? I learned a lot of things from her. But what I learned from her on this point is life is stronger than all of us. Life keeps moving. You can cut branches off of trees. You can endanger them. But life keeps moving. Trees keep growing. That's the way things are. So I completely agree with Rabbi Bravender's analysis of what happened. But I think also that Rabbi Sherlo, who I know personally, we talk often, Rabbi Sherlo, I think, was trying to express the pain that exists on both sides. But pain is part of living. There is no such thing as life without pain. And part of growing the state of Israel are these painful moments. And I like to look at the state of Israel as like the face of a teenager. It might be filled with outrageous pimples, but behind it there's a young, beautiful face there. And eventually the pimples are going to subside, the acne is going to subside, and that teenage face is going to grow into a very nice young adult. And then when they get to young adulthood, you're not going to look back and say, think of all the times you argued with them and they stamped out of the house and there were problems, because now they're a responsible young adult contributing to society. And I the disengagement process was painful for all of us. And I have a lot to say about it, but not right now. But the bottom line is, Israel is not moving toward a rupture. Israel is much stronger than that. There's a divine hand guiding everything that's happening there. And we're going to argue, and we're going to fight, and we're going to continue to grow the country and settle the country and develop the country. And eventually, all of these things are going to become blips on the historical screen.
First of all, there's some background people should know that Rav Shurlo, for those who don't know him, is known for making very strong, sometimes some people call them outrageous statements. The second thing about the statement, that it came only a few months after the disengagement and certainly before the war. I think I would agree with the other panel members, and in retrospect, that rupture is much too strong a word for the process that has followed the disengagement. By the same token, I think the observation of divergent narratives of what the state of Israel is all about existed before the disengagement. It was just brought out by the disengagement. And there's a very interesting movement that took place right before the disengagement that my son, who was then 14 years old, took part in. He, much more than myself, identifies with the movement that fought against the disengagement. He's in the high school at the Merkaz Arav Yeshiva. And along with his friends, one of the things they did, and perhaps the most constructive thing, I would say, is to form a movement, organization called Panim El Panim. The idea of Panim El Panim was for people who were by and large religious to go and visit, ideally secular, any Jews that would be ignorant of the religious perspective, or at least the right-wing perspective on the disengagement, and simply to go to their houses to engage them in conversation over tea, etc., whatever the case may be. People who were involved in this found it to be highly successful, but in retrospect, when one looks at the numbers and lack of true support to fight against the disengagement politically, one questions the effectiveness, and I think that the problem is one of too little too late, of a realization that there, before the territorial disengagement, there was a disengagement of the religious Zionist population from the general population in Israel. I think that is what's really being pointed out by the disparate narratives. The disparate narratives are not just one of disengagement in Gush Katif, but go through their understanding of the state, of the Jewish people. And I think the issue becomes, are we prepared to re-engage, meaning religious Zionists, but all Orthodox really, are we really prepared to re-engage with the rest of the population in Israel? And if the answer is no, and it may well be for many people who are afraid of exposing ourselves to the dangers of being in contact with an admittedly increasingly decadent society. If the answer is no, then perhaps rupture is too strong a word right now, but it may be, in fact, the tale of the future.
And just one point, or response to the issue of re-engagement. I'm not making a political statement, but I am certainly taking a different position than some of the people here regarding settlement. I think that settlement is a very complicated thing, and I know that for a majority of Orthodox Jews in North America, there's absolute allegiance to the settlement movement. I just want to point out two things that we should consider, and it complicates the message. And I guess this is a crowd where people want complex messages or are willing to address them. I study contemporary Jewry. I also study 19th century European Jewry, European Orthodoxy. And that was a period when the concept of Orthodox separation emerged among the Hirschians in Frankfurt, among the students of the Chatam Sofer in Hamburg. And as utopian as in many ways a lot of the settlements are, and we visit them, and I studied in Alon Shvut, I have a son who's first year in Hesder and Gush now, And I feel like I'm in paradise. When I took my son 2 months ago to start yeshiva, I drove him there and I said, here are the keys, you can drive home, I'm staying. You know, I didn't want to go anywhere. This is, you know, where it all happened for me. Having said this, I think that we've created ghettos. We've created fences. If we talk about being disengaged, when some of our best and brightest grow up in environments where they have almost no contact whatsoever with Jews who are different than them until they go to the army, I think that's a problem. I don't think that's a simple thing. When you spend a Shabbos in a yeshuv, you feel great. But when you think about these things and some of the problems that have developed as a result, you realize it's not so simple. And on a broader level, there's also the question of cost. And I hope this doesn't come across as materialistic. Rabbi Bravender is absolutely right that at a certain point, religious parties in Israel use their political capital in order to develop educational environments which nurtured young men and women who were more committed to Torah and developed a new generation. But that was primarily in the Haredi world. Most of the major political capital that the religious Zionist community has had since around 1973 has been dedicated purely to land and settlement issues. And the result is that I have 4 sons who are in 7th grade and above and are studying in religious science institutions. And I would say almost half of my monthly salary goes to paying their tuition. Now, we always hear about tuitions in America, and we always hear about the issue of what we call sort of economic assimilation, but the fact that we had religious Zionist education ministers, we had people who were very, very involved in coalitions, and somehow lots and lots and lots of capital of funds were dedicated towards religious goals, but almost very little of it went towards religious education, religious Zionist education. If we're seeing a crisis of sorts and we're seeing a move towards a Haredization to a certain degree in some of the youth from a religious Zionist upbringing, I think that that is part of the problem. On a more optimistic note, this is going to sound not so optimistic, I spent a lot of time this summer, like many of us, going to funerals. Was terrible. One of the worst was a funeral for a young man by the name of, his last name is Zussman, who grew up in my community in Kfar Saba, where I live, which is a town of 100,000 Jews with about 20% who are Orthodox, from a lovely family. And he lived in Beit El, had studied in the yeshiva, he lived in Eli and he had studied in the yeshiva in Eli. And he was married, and he had a 7-month-old baby. And he was killed when there was an anti-tank missile which hit a building with 12 soldiers in it, and about 2 days before the war ended. It was a horrible, horrible, tragic death, as so many of them were. It happened to be that by the time they could organize the funeral, it was 10 o'clock at night, and thousands of people came to Kfar Saba, and we marched together silently about a 25-minute walk with the family in the front, arm in arm, following the army truck with the coffin from the synagogue where he grew up in to the local military cemetery. And they didn't stop there, and there were hespedim, there were eulogies. The one that I will never forget is the one that his wife, his almana, had the bravery, the presence to actually speak at her husband's funeral. And what she said was that before her husband was called, when he was called to Miluim and he was about to go out to the army and he knew he was going to be in Lebanon for a protracted amount of time and it was scary, he looked at her and he said, you know, last summer, we were torn apart. There was so much hatred. There was so much animosity within Israeli society. Maybe, in an unfortunate way, this is a HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way of bringing us back together and making us realize that we do have more which brings us close together than that which rips us apart. For a young man to think that is very powerful. For a bride with a 7-month-old to say that at her husband's funeral is even more powerful. I think what would be even more powerful is if we could somehow find a way not to wait for the Hezbollah to remind us of this and come up. It's probably impossible. I don't know. We've been trying for so many generations. But somehow figure out how to remember that we have more in common before we have to lose so many precious young lives.
I want to comment on Rabbi Furziger's remarks about settlements. We're good friends, Adam. Please take this in the right way. But I think on this issue, I think that you're really mistaken. I lived in Ra'anana for 9 years after I came on Aliyah. And those of you that know Ra'anana know that it's about 60, 70,000 people, of which about 25% are religious. And in the last 3 years that I lived in Ra'anana, from 1993 to 1996, I spent a lot of time in the Ra'anana Junction leading demonstrations against the Oslo Accords. And in 1996, my wife and I decided to move to a settlement to Elkana in the Shomron, where we have lived for the last 10 years. And our children, some of our children we raised in Ra'anana, some of them we raised in Elkana. And I want to tell you something. There is no doubt that there's an issue about separating from the general population in order to form a settlement and live there. Elkana is 90% religious. It's closed on Shabbat. There's about 2,000 kids who live there. It's Shabbat there is like it's an unbelievable experience. And I can understand what some people like Rabbi Furziger say about the dangers in pulling away from the general society and forming settlements. But let me tell you something. The religious Zionist world in Israel, in terms of its religious intensity and the learning of Torah and the doing of mitzvot, left a lot to be desired for a long time. If you look in the religious Zionist yeshivas until very recently, if they wanted rebbeim, they had to hire them from the Haredi world because we weren't producing our own lamdanim enough that we're capable of teaching Torah at a high level. Not only that, but the level of our commitment to mitzvot, in terms of hakpada on mitzvot, was not something to write home about. But the formation of settlements, which were entirely religious, created environments in which these communities could work on their intensity. And religious life became more intense in those communities. Yeshivas, religious Zionist yeshivas in those kinds of communities, became more intense. And the result is that the seriousness of the religious Zionist movement in Israel now is far greater than it was before. We are now producing Talmidei Chachamim. We're producing children who are very, very heavily invested in the learning of Torah and the doing of mitzvot. I can say that all of my children, with the exception of one, all of my children are stronger and more knowledgeable than I am. And it was from the experience of living in a settlement that that happened. Because they did not have to deal, you should excuse me, with the sewer of the Israeli street. In the secular society in Israel, the values are debilitating, they are corrupt, they are objectionable. And I see no great value in us raising our children to walk around the streets of Ra'anana or Kfar Sava or other cities and see the some of the moral filth that is going on there. I see a much greater value in the children growing up in environments where they are gaining purity, holiness, depth of Torah, so that as long as they are raised with the sensitivity that they have to give back, which thank God my children have, And they give back to Israeli society that holiness and that purity and that intensity, which in my opinion has a much greater value than the pariv kind of Yiddishkeit that they would have had if they had learned watching their step on the streets of Ra'anana. Now, I know that that's insulting to say that in some ways to some elements of the Israeli population. But I can tell you this. Over the long run, and I see it in North America also. I was a rabbi in North America for in Calgary, and I train rabbis, and I travel North America widely. And I can tell you that what we call the modern Orthodox movement in North America has a lot of work to do. It has a lot of work to do in its seriousness of learning, has a lot to do in its seriousness in the keeping of mitzvot. We have a tendency to get on a high horse and think, well, we're modern. We're modern Orthodox. And therefore, and we have a tendency to bash the Haredi populations to our right, which is an act of utter stupidity, because we have a tremendous amount to learn from the Haredi population. Their intensity in learning and commitment to mitzvot, halavai aleinu. Now, when we went into these settlements and we built these places, we created crucibles where children became serious. Those children, with their seriousness, will give a depth to Israeli society, which is what will transform the state into a Torah state eventually. And although some of us are concerned about being very, very sensitive and touchy-feely with the rest of the population, what I want, first and foremost, is to transform Israeli society into a true Jewish society, which will become an Or LeGoyim. And if that can be created faster and better by children who've grown up in puristic kind of settlements where they can then give something purer and deeper and richer to the society, I'm all for it.
We could go on for a long time, but I did want to allow for questions on the floor. I do have something to say, however. I've just heard in the last number of minutes a sort of questioning or outright denial or marginalization of Rabbi Shurlo's thesis. And I'm listening to you gentlemen talk, and I'm actually seeing his thesis come to life. Because it struck me, actually, that the two of you are arguing apples and oranges. You, Rabbi Haman, seems to me validly, are arguing that it was the movement towards settlement that created a revitalization of the spiritual energies and the seriousness of religious observance in the modern Orthodox community, and that is a good thing. On the other hand, you, Rabbi Furtziger, are arguing that the other side of the coin is that the price paid for this, say, improvement in the quality of the religious life of religious Zionists is a separation, a kind of divide from the rest of the public. The question, so therefore we have, if you don't want to call it rupture, I will call it division. The question then becomes, and the disengagement to me becomes symbolic of this, of how these two, what the Canadian author Hugh McClellan called two solitudes, will reengage, reunite. What will be the patterns that will allow for that? You know, because if the perception is that we have to stay within our Dalai Mamo because the Israeli street is a sewer, I'm not going to question that one way or the other. It sounds like a divide, and a divide that's not going to be quickly bridged.
But why do religious people always have to take the position of defending their right to their values and their culture just because we want to be nice to the rest of the population? Before being nice, I want to be real. And being real means being committed with everything that I have to the study of Torah and the doing of mitzvot. That's what I am. So I have to apologize. Why do I have to apologize for that? Or why do I have to mitigate who I am in order to be nice to people who do not value that? I want to be nice, but it's even more important than being nice. I want to be real, and that's my first obligation. And I think that the religious community has to change its mindset. It's not a matter of triumphalism. It's a matter of being authentic and being real.
Rabbi Haman is right.
I'm the moderator.
When I came to Israel,
I don't get to argue with you.
When I came, the Mafdal, that it was called Mizrahi. There was such a thing. Mizrahi, they had a building company. The building company is called Mishav. Mishav still exists. A lot of people make a lot of money because Mishav exists. In those days, Mishav never built a building in a religious neighborhood. They only built buildings in mixed neighborhoods. Today, Mishav never builds a building in a mixed neighborhood. They only build buildings in religious neighborhoods because everybody understands. You want to send your little children to a gan that's close to home. You want to send them to a school that has other children like them who have the similar ideals and similar. So what I mean is that it's not simply the settlements that provided the infrastructure for this change in attitude, but that this change in attitude is widespread, and in this way they followed the Haredim, who could not conceive of any other kind of system of living, right? They couldn't conceive of it. But I think what Dr. Furtziger said was something else, that in building many of the settlements, some of them small, not so viable, a tremendous amount of money was expended that might be used more effectively in developing general educational systems. This is not, I think, is not exactly the same thing. And it's true that Elkanah is a very big yeshuv that has been very successful in running educational institutions. But there are yeshuvim which have very small numbers of people that are supported by tremendous amounts of money, relatively speaking. And it may be that that money could be more wisely spent elsewhere. So everybody's right.
I'm going to say that everybody's wrong. So,
that, oh, come on.
Now, the truth is I agree with many of the points that were made, and I feel like a little bit of a hypocrite arguing somewhat against what Rabbi Hyman said, and I feel guilt for living in a religious neighborhood. The trend, I think, as Rabbi Bravender identified, extends far beyond the settlements. I think the trend is a national trend to create religious ghettos, which in fact does take the Haredi model and has adopted it to the national religious public as well.
Why are they ghettos? There are no gates. I mean, you can drive in and out. I mean, it's not exactly a ghetto.
And why do you feel guilty about it?
Now, I'll tell you what.
Let him tell you.
Yeah. Right. I was asked to say where I live.
I live in the 17th century, but it's not a ghetto.
I live in Harnof, which is, I think we had less than 1% of the population voting for any parties besides the religious parties. And the reasons that I moved there, I continue to live there, are very much the reasons that Rabbi Hyman identified on a personal level. And I think a lot of us face this as a very real issue, that we want strong families and we want to avoid the, I don't know if the gutter is the right idea, is the right word, but certainly we want to avoid the cultural threats to our religious identity. So I think it's very true. By the same token, I think we have to at least be aware that there is a tremendous price being paid for this ghettoization, that there's a Jewish value of arevut. There's a Jewish value of being concerned about the other ones who are in this sewer, that the fact that they're not able to see models of Jewish life, of Jewish behavior, until they're 20 in the army, and if then, as has been mentioned, certainly the models are limited and becoming more limited. It's no surprise that the attitudes of the secular majority, even if it becomes a minority, will be one that does not understand and has no conception of what a positive thing Jewish religious life can be. I think that whether we're going to win the demographic battle or not, we need to be concerned about those Jews. And for us to move in the direction that we're all moving, to live only amongst ourselves, it may be something that is unavoidable. By the same token, we have to realize the heavy price that we're paying for it.
First of all, I'd like everybody to give these gentlemen a hand. I know the hour is late, and I know there are some people who want to leave, and there are some people who want to ask questions, and I want everybody to do exactly what their desire is. So if you do want to leave, no problem. It's quite a bit after our time. If you could just slip out quietly. If you want to ask a question, our sound wizard, David Callender, is holding the mic at the back of the room. So if you could put up your hand. And the protocol for questioning is that you should say who you're addressing your question to. We're going to take a bunch at the same time. In other words, David's going to go around and gather a bunch of questions. We'll write them down, and then we'll answer them. I also, of course, want to invite you all to come back tomorrow, where we'll have a day of great programming, and we're going to be starting at 9 o'clock and running all day. So if you do have a question, please raise your hand, and David will come to you.
Check 1, 2, 2.
No question.
Okay. Why is the disengagement very bad in Israel right now?
Okay. Is that a good question? Next. Over here. Hang on a sec.
Please, for the recording, if we can get you on the mic here, please.
My question is to Rabbi Bravender. I understand that at a certain point he was accepting the whole idea of disengagement just because of the willingness to avoid the division in the country. My question to him is, when he came to this decision and to this agreement, whether he really thought about some consequences that will happen in the future, such as this will give a very strong backwind to the terrorists, and we saw that it really happened, that actually the whole war that happened in Lebanon was as a result, and everybody agrees, was a result of the disengagement in Gush Katif, that the American administration was also against the disengagement because it was such a one-sided thing, and whether after it all happened and it turned out that the compensation to the people who evacuated from there was very, very minimal, and as a result, many of them are in a very, very desperate economical situation, where he still agrees that in order to avoid division, we shall go on with our life and just forget about the whole thing.
Okay. There's one more, and that's all.
I try to avoid saying that.
My question is basically anybody can answer it. Rabbi Nitzhaf, you mentioned that, and I agree with you, that a lot of the problem with the secular Israelis is that I think it's not even a problem in Israel, but Chutz La'aretz as well, that we have a generation of a world that's completely in dire straits, where people are dying everywhere, and it's not such a pretty world, and people are looking now towards how can we fix this world, people that are from more affluent societies and are attracted to call it the Pinsula Yidden side or call it Chesley Jewish soul or whatever you want, but we're attracted to things that such as Tikkun and the only people, Tikkun Olam and all these things
I'm just going to ask if you can just formulate the question.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you.
So how then do we address it to these Jews, to people? How do we make Orthodox Judaism more attractive to Jews that are looking for this?
I want to clarify. What's your name?
Michael.
Michael, I think I said something else. This is what I said. I am not prepared to take a stand now, here, on whether disengagement was good or not, whether I agreed with it or I didn't agree with it. I didn't take a stand on that. What I said was that after the disengagement was over, you see that the people in the state of Israel were not prepared to give up the state of Israel for a revolution about disengagement. I recognize very well that there's a tremendous amount of tragedy that was caused by the disengagement, which is certainly unfortunate at best, and at worst is a desecration of anything that any reasonable person would imagine. But I didn't focus on that. I focused on the fact that most Israelis think that Israel is more important than having a battle de facto about what happened. And in fact, you know that the party of disengagement, which is Kadima, was elected, basically, in the election. I mean, they received the largest number of votes and have the largest number of seats in the Knesset. And they were able to form a coalition even with other parties like Israel Beiteinu today, which would be terribly against disengagement and against any kind of appeasement with the Arabs, et cetera.
Yeah, just to answer the other question in terms of making Orthodoxy more attractive, this is a much longer discussion, but I think we within Orthodoxy are lacking the true depth, the true vision, understanding the spiritual side and message of Orthodoxy. I think we're falling into a trap that we call panhalakha, where everything becomes halachic. I think it's time for us to see Judaism as others would want to see it, because we ourselves should see that. I mean, techniques such as meditation, issues of meditation, of tefillah, of music, all this should take a larger part.
Art.
Art, right, Ravinder will tell you about tomorrow. These are all important facets of Judaism that we overlook to our own detriment. But again, it's a much longer topic.
Final comments.
Hey, I know at the beginning of the session, before I arrived, people at my very esteemed colleagues on the panel were asked why they made Aliyah. And it is important for me to share this with you. I don't know if it's original. I didn't make Aliyah because I didn't like where I grew up. I love America, and I love American culture, and I feel that there's a lot of tremendous, tremendous things that I got from growing up within American Jewry, and I have nothing negative to say about American Jewry. You know, we all can criticize individual issues, but in general, I think that I gained a tremendous amount. I also didn't make Aliyah because it's a mitzvah. I know Ramban said it's a mitzvah. A lot of people say, you know, you can discuss it, but maybe that's my weakness, but it wasn't a compelling enough reason for me to make Aliyah. The reason I made Aliyah, I'm pretty sure, maybe I couldn't articulate it when I was 22 when we moved to Israel, but I think I felt the same way then. It's because I wanted to be a participant in the great experiment in Jewish history. And I emphasize the word experiment. To be a part of something that I knew there were no guarantees about, and I'm not 100% sure that it's going to work out the way we would like it to be. I really hope. But I did know that I wanted to try, and I wanted to know that I could tell myself that something that my grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents couldn't even do if they wanted to, if I had that opportunity, I would want to be able to say to myself that I was a part of that and I tried my best in whatever way I was capable of. And again, this should be taken in a positive way. And I'm very, very reticent and very, very, I try to be very careful in not being an Israeli coming to Americans and telling them how to be. We have a tendency in Israel to do that. Amos Oz is a wonderful writer, secular Jew, very, you know, outspokenly secular Jew, said something very interesting at a lecture that I heard. He said, you know, people say, well, who's a Zionist? Some people say, a Zionist is, to be a Zionist, you have to live in Israel. Other people say to be a Zionist is someone who gives money to Israel. To be a Zionist is somebody who campaigns for Israel. What does it mean to be a Zionist? So he said, you know, I think anyone who supports the state of Israel is a Zionist. But I look at it like a ball game or like a play in the theater. When you go to a ball game, Well, there's the playing field, and there's the seats, and there are the spectators. All of them are part of the event, and all of them have what to contribute to that event, and that event would not take place without all those different participants and parts. The question is, does one want to sit in the seats and watch, or does one want to be a player on the field? I feel, personally, that being a player on the field is a challenge, it's scary, it's wonderful, it's empowering, and it's where I can be a part of that great experiment. But we all, in whatever environment we're in, I think it's important for us to feel that we are part of that same game and we're working together to achieve common goals.
Thank you very much.